This is Steve Sherlock with another in the series of podcasts for Franklin Matters. This is number 113 in the series. This is part two to the SAFE Coalition meeting of August 12th, 2015. As you heard in the first part, Dr. John Kelly gave his presentation. This second part is a multi-member panel discussion with audience questions. The audio thereby is a little bit, you can listen to it. Each speaker's voice is somewhat different volume, so you'll just be aware of that, and you may have to adjust it from time to time, and then adjust it back from a soft speaker to a loud speaker. But it is distinct and clear otherwise. You should be able to make it out. If you have any complaints about it, by all means, let me know. And we'll factor that in for next time. So without further ado, here's part two for the multi-member panel discussion from the SAFE Coalition meeting on August 12th.
All right, at this point, I'm going to ask the members of the panel if they'll come on up and please gather. I know that they're going to raise the screen, so you won't be looking at their feet all night. But while those folks are gathering, I did want to take this opportunity to recognize our elected officials who have joined us tonight. From the Franklin Town Council, we have Tom Mercer, Peter Padula, Robert DeLorco, and Brett Feldman. From the school committee, we have Susan Rohrbach. Our town administrator, Jeff Nutting, has joined us. Our school superintendent, Maureen Sevalinski, is here. Police Chief Steve Subergin is here. We have some representatives from the fire department. I know that from the Community of Hope, Jim Derrick wasn't able to join us tonight, but I know Kathy Getchell is here. If anybody's interested in information on Community of Hope, if Kathy is in the room, if you could raise your hand. Oh, she's way up in the back. She's a back row seat. And I know Jennifer Knight is here. She's the one who is facilitating the Healing Hearts. Jennifer, if you could raise your hand. And there she is, another back row. So if you have any questions on those particular groups, by all means. And at this point, I see only, come on in, take your seats at the table. And I will briefly tell you who's joining us here tonight. Dr. John Kelly, who you have met already. Jonathan Cabezas, he's 26 years old, and he's currently the Director of Services at number 16 in Wakefield. We have Brooke, who's 39 years old and has been an opiate addiction since 2003. She's been clean for several months now. And Amy Leone, who's from Community Impact in Milford. You might recognize her from our last panel discussion. And we have Dan Lynch from the Lynch Wellness and Recovery Foundation. And Jennifer Rowe is joining us from the Norfolk District Attorney's Office. I'm going to ask them to briefly take a minute or two to tell us about what you do and who you are. And while they're introducing themselves, I'd ask if anybody has a question or a comment, begin lining up at the podiums that are right in the aisle. So why don't you start us, Jim?
Thank you very much for...
got to get the technology.
Thank you very much for including me in the presentation tonight. My name is Jennifer Burrow. I'm an assistant DA here in Norfolk County and the director of the Department of Engineering for the 2018 Executive Prize in Norfolk County, Franklin obviously being one of them. I started as a prosecutor a little over 20 years in Suffolk County, and for the last 10 years, I've had the privilege of serving here in Norfolk County, where I grew up and where my husband and I are raising our two. And I can tell you that our focus is on the preventable causes of death in Norfolk County. And for us, those are opiate overdose and impaired driving. So we are a substance abuse county. We're not a gun violence county. I feel that there's a lot of very important work that can happen at the community level, and I attend attend many events like this across Norfolk County, I can tell you that there are two ways I typically see an auditorium full, and that's when there's a mandatory event for parents or if there's a tragedy. And you've done it here in Franklin without either of those, so you have very much to be proud of here.
I have my own microphone. Hi, my name is Danny Lynch. I'm a licensed alcohol and drug counselor with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I'm also a certified intervention professional. I do have a private practice in Norwell, Mass., and it is Lynch Wellness Recovery Foundation. I'm also, as of Monday, going to be the National Treatment Advisor for Origins Behavioral Healthcare based out of West Palm. And I've been working in the field of addiction for over 29 years, and I'm proud to say, as Dr. John eloquently talked about, I'm a man in recovery. I've been a sober man for 31 years. I went to treatment myself back in 1983, and I've been doing what I've needed to do to maintain my sobriety. So I say that because I want to be a voice for recovery. I want to let you know that no matter who is struggling in this room with a loved one who has an addiction problem, that there's hope, and that you can, if given the opportunity and the commitment from both the individual and the family, you can get well a day at a time. So thank you.
People that can't get out to meetings. I do public relations.
And I joined this because I'd like to see Franklin also get help for the addicts. The addicts who need something 7 nights a week, it would be great if you get something 2 meetings a day in this town. Because right now I don't really see a recovery for addicts in this town. I know of 2 meetings and that's it. So my goal is to actually try to, I have a sponsor and there's a group of us who'd like to get meetings 7 nights a week at least in this town. Thank you.
Hi everybody, my name is John Basis. I grew up not too far away in Holland. I like to think I had a very stereotypical drug addiction experience, believe it or not. I ran through the gamut of what you hear in most halls of AA, starting with smoking marijuana after baseball practice as a really young kid, and very quickly graduated into the opiates with the Percocets, and I began using heroin at a very young age, which brought me to being kicked out of high school my junior year, losing at the time what was the most important part of my life, which was playing high school sports. And before you knew it, fast forward a few years, I'm 20 years old, and I've overdosed multiple times, attempted suicide twice, provided nothing for my family except heartache and tragedy, and I didn't know what to do myself. I was in that psychiatric unit's jail, so I accumulated a criminal record that would probably and most likely would follow me for the rest of my life. And I was fortunate enough to find myself landing in a very cutting edge sober living environment, Wakefield, Mass. And I moved out there just over 6 years ago. I've been pretty sober ever since. And I've actually had the privilege of working there for the past 4 years as they expanded a bit. And the privilege and honor of working with hundreds of addicts and their families over that time. I'm somebody who's in, I like to think I'm an absolute open book. I like to speak from my experience, the experiences I've learned from others. So, if there's anything you feel might cross the line as far as the question goes, I'd be more than willing to take it on. I'm not afraid to share anything I'm not going to do. Thank you.
I have two questions. One for a quick direction before I answer to the doctor. The first one, I used to work as a registered nurse in maternity, and this is years ago. And so I did get to see babies that were addicted. So I know that the governor has announced that there's a $3 million grant, I believe it is, for addicted and pregnant women. So I'm wondering how that would be implemented so that women who need the service will know about it, or doctors will know how to refer the women. And then if you'd like to answer about the second question.
Well, I don't have a direct answer. The governor is setting up that program, and it'll be through education programs like this that we will get the word out as quick as possible as to how to access it. And there'll be a number of programs that will be announced over the next several months as we come to terms with our obligations. And I learned a lot from the presentation Dr. Kelly gave tonight. I can see issues that the legislature is facing on a number of fronts, and one of the big ones is funding for these types of programs. So we will keep you, I hope you're a subscriber to
yes.
the newsletter, and we'll bring information to an event like this. In fact, we're planning on doing a government-focused event in the next couple of months where we'll bring out, hopefully, the Attorney General to come out and talk to us and other members of the legislature and the governor's office to come and talk about those very questions.
Yeah, because it's great to have the programs, but if the ladies don't know about them or the doctors don't know they're there, then it's really no good. And then you've got the babies being delivered, and it's kind of like then you're treating the baby and the mother. It's a thin pulling the baby away from the mother at that point. And that's a big cost. You said there was a cost and where you could have maybe helped ahead of time, but you got to know how to find those services. So then the second question is, Dr., could you please explain a little bit? How withdrawal impacts recovery and addiction. You talk about dopamine and dependence and have to take a little bit more. But when people are addicted, they're trying to get off and they're going back and say falling off and trying to get back on. How does withdrawal impact? What is that mechanism that makes it so hard to withdraw that?
can do. How does what?
Withdrawal.
How does withdrawal?
Withdrawal from the drugs, the alcohol, the opioids. How does that impact your recovery? Because you talk a lot about dependence and how if you need a little bit more, and that impacts the person, that impacts the brain. But when they stop taking it, they seem the withdrawal factor.
To withdraw. Does the acute withdrawal and post-acute withdrawal? And so, what we do know is that in a multiple episode of withdrawal is associated with more disruption in the brain. So the more time you go through withdrawal, actually, it's a bad indicator, bad prognostic indicator. It's also it's a marker, of course. You know, more time you go through withdrawal, it's a marker of severity. So there is the withdrawal and the post-acute withdrawal. So in acute withdrawal, that usually lasts only for 5 to 10 days, and then people can be stabilized within that period. But then, the most significant and important part is the down-regulation that has occurred, which takes a long time to change. So for the brain to recalibrate and re-upregulate those receptor systems, can take anywhere from months to maybe a couple of years or more, depending on the person, how much they've been using, for how long, what intensity, and then learning the biology and genes will affect all of that trajectory. But it can take a while for that post-acute withdrawal phase to manifest and for people's brains to change that, so they're not suffering from those post-acute withdrawal symptoms.
I just have something to add to that too. I think as well with withdrawals, what I see a lot with my clients who are relapsing is the fact of understanding the unquiet mind that they have, the mental obsession of wanting the drug and just continuing to want more and more and more. And so there's a lot about trying to refocus that mind, deal with that mental obsession. I'm sure that's a lot that you learn through recovery and 12 steps and stuff, but that is a big factor. And I think all of us have that mental obsession in some way or another. So.
Hello, my name is Gail Sherman. I'm a retired psychiatric clinical nurse specialist. I've had the experience of working as a psychotherapist in the city of Boston with HIV/AIDS clients. And also, one of my specialties has been working with the elderly. And I guess, I don't know if this is a comment or a question, Dr. Kelly, but your one slide that showed the minuscule addiction for the elderly, I was wondering where that information was gotten from, because when I think of aging, and I'm there already, a lot of aches and pains, and with the elderly, you have a lot of chronic illnesses involved in pain of one sort or another. And I would see this as an up-and-coming age group that will be highly addicted with the way the new narcotics, the opioids are being produced and handed out. And I know that takes educating of our medical establishment, particularly the nurses and doctors that prescribe. But also, the numbers seem so low for the elderly. And I was wondering if there's ever going to be any ongoing studies with that age group for this particular issue.
Yeah, that's a very important question. We do see overall, again, those population data, so disproportionately, we tend to see the most use of all, both illicit and illicit drugs, whether that's misuse, opioid prescriptions, or alcohol, heaviest use in the young adult years. That's pretty universal. You see it peaks and then it does tend to drop off. But we have an aging population. They're living longer. And we've got more and more medications coming aboard. We don't see those rates of addiction. We may see more prescribed opioid dependence, but not so much drug seeking behavior, so they're less likely to go and seek heroin if they do become addicted to prescription opioids, and more likely to go back and see their doctor and have it managed more through their doctor than they would from seeking drugs on the street than other people would. But you raise an important point. Again, it points toward proper management of pain. Now, I was just had a colleague over from Norway, where only we consume 80% or 85% of the world's opioids in terms of pain in this country, with only 5% of the world's population. In Norway, and most Scandinavian countries, they only use opioids as a last resort for pain. So there's many more different ways of dealing with pain than we do in the United States. And so we think we can look at opioids, other pain management methods. It can be very important, opioid pain management, but there are many other tools that we can use.
Thank you very much also for addressing the word stigma. I think that's really key, and especially with the older population. It is with every age group, but I can think when my father was dying from cancer, he was 64, and his oncologist wanted to put him on cannabis for his pain. He said, "Oh no, I'm not going to get addicted," you know. And he didn't have that long to live, but it was just the whole genre of addictions then. And this goes back to the early 80s. Thank you.
Just a moment. This is an educational forum, and I hope that you know, we get leave here tonight with some information. While it's fresh in my mind, there's two books out there. This book here, titled Love First, for those family members or somebody who is thinking about intervening on a loved one, this is a great book, a great tool to use when in preparing and contemplating doing a family intervention. It's kind of Love First by Deborah J. and her husband, Jeff J. In addition to this book, there's a similar book on aging and addiction, written by Deborah J. and another woman by Ms. Collin. And aging and addiction, it's a great book to answer some of your questions around. And you're right, as we, the population in this country is moving into, more boomers and older adults, generation, growing population of homeless and older adults. And a lot of them are coming into treatment now with poly addiction, not just alcohol. They have pain medications on board. They have psychiatric medications on board, benzodiazepines. And so they come into treatment, these homeless and older adults, maybe 20 different prescriptions. And, when we talk about stigma, even the physicians today, I'm not knocking doctors, there's some great doctors out there doing some great work, and they know how to identify addiction. But there's a lot of docs out there and professionals who are, prescribing, one treating the symptom of a situation. And so I'm seeing, especially at the Hanley Center, where we treat boomers and older adults, these folks are now coming in, the Woodstockers of the back in the day are coming in with poly addiction, all kinds of medical problems, and as Dr. Kelly said, co-occurring disorders as well, the addiction and the mental health piece. So it's certainly an area in that population we need to address more. I think those numbers we saw today might be, inflated as far as the homes and the old adults. But that book, Aging and Addiction, is a great tool to kind of give you some more information on how to work with that population.
Thank you very much.
I know that you were in line first, so I will take you and then we'll move to the side of them.
Okay, thank you.
If you don't mind identifying yourself.
I'm Katie Truitt. I'm actually from the Missing Matt Foundation. I'm an asthma. I have three children. Two of them suffer from heroin addiction, and I lost my son Matthew in November 2012. My question to you is, I noticed you had a lot of statistics people suffering from a substance abuse disorder that have families that are in recovery. Do you see that people, individuals that are suffering, do better when families are also in recovery and getting that support from families? I mean, I think it's very, very important for families, especially if I speak for myself as a parent, to see some data showing, you know, certain age groups, you know, that have families that are in recovery, the likelihood of their recovery.
Yes.
And
those, you know, the family, support families being in recovery, having role models, close role models, and examples of what recovery can and does look like. That's very powerful, both for families, family members, and also other people in the social network. So yeah, all other things being equal, the more people you have close to you who are recovery role models, the higher your odds of recovery.
Well, because I mean, it will also help you get stigma. You know, because I believe there's so many family members that suffer from the stigma as well. We parents sometimes think we did something wrong, and that's why our children suffer. And if we, you know, if we get in recovery ourselves, you know, like with support groups, like going to Cove and so forth, you know, we can give support to our loved ones and not show, and not feel stigma of ourselves. That's what our foundation is about as well. We have an awareness walk. We want to have a voice in our lives. We're trying to get people together to just have a voice. Let's talk about this. These are not bad people. You know, we're not bad people. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the opportunity.
She's not mad. She has her recovery, and I have my recovery. And the way it's working with us is I've laid it all on the table. There's nothing, like, I don't care if I blow an anonymity. I'm not hiding because I'm an addict. I wasn't expecting to be one, but I am. And I have my recovery. She supports me only in my recovery. And I support her in her recovery, and that's what it has to be. But I see it as you got to kind of throw everything on the table and be open and honest too. And if she does her own recovery, I do mine. And she's starting to work the 12 steps as well.
And Katie had mentioned that there's going to be an awareness walk in Milford. Katie, that's September 12th.
September 12th.
September 12th. So I do send notices out about that event in the newsletter. Ask the folks to please join that and support that effort.
My name is Rich. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I just want the families here to know that this could be done. And it is not easy. And it shakes everybody in the whole family and right now our community. And it's going to take the support of everybody here to help just one individual. One individual. I go to a lot of meetings and so forth, and when we do that, we say a prayer for all the people that are still out. You know, we pray that in some way, in some direction, they can find their way to the doors of AA or Canada. And Al-Anon for the family. Al-Anon is a very important part of recovery. Everybody in the family needs to understand on what's available and how the family can reunite and rework together. It's extremely hard. I got sober a long time ago, and when I did, and this is a question I have for our political force up on my panel, and I want to thank the doctor and everybody else for doing a great job. You know, funding in Massachusetts, it's an excellent thing that funding was put aside for this program and programs like this. But when I came through, if you did not have insurance, there was plenty of state facilities that a heroin addict or an alcoholic could go to. They evaporated over the last 10 years. I, today, try to get people placed in places, and where you could 20, 30 years ago pick up the phone and get something placed that night, two or three places would take it. Now they do not take it, and they're put on hold. And what occurs because of the safety of an alcoholic or a drug addict is that they put them in a holding bin until something is open. I think the mayor of Boston and the governor himself have mentioned the fact that they're going to extend and revisit this addiction problem we have. And by that I mean that they're going to put more beds available for people who are looking for treatment. There's a lot of people out there that need treatment. They don't have the means or the guest to. We are in an affluent community here. And this is a statewide situation. And our problem is just not in Franklin because our drugs are coming into other towns. And if those people in there, they can't find some sort of services provided by the state, if they can come up with the money for programs like this here, after some sort of discussion and debate, I can't understand why more money can't be put aside. If you want to get to the root of this problem, as the doctor explained to all of us, it has to start with some sort of medical treatment for people who do not have the money for it. Thank you.
I did want to make sure that I shared with you that in 2013, a federal grant became available through the Bureau of Justice Assistance that was awarded to six places in the country that was designed to develop data-driven strategies to prevent opiate overdose. And there were two locations on the East Coast. One was Manhattan, and the other was the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office. And while I'd like to think that that funding was awarded because of the grant that we submitted, the reality is that we were funded to do that work here in Norfolk County is because that is the scope of our problem. And so with that funding, we've done two important things that I wanted to make sure that I shared with you to put our opiate overdose problem into perspective in what's going on in your backyard. The first thing we did was to build community coalitions to serve as a conduit for that we knew that we were going to be generating, and that's what you're doing here tonight. The second was to develop data-driven strategies from overdoses. So we now hold overdose data-driven meetings in the Norfolk District Attorney's Office. Chief Samaritan, who is designated, is there at each of those meetings, along with the homicide detectives assigned to Norfolk County, DEA, commanding officers from NORCAC, our narcotics investigators, as well as investigators from the Board of Registration and Medicine and the Office of Public Protection that governs pharmacy, nursing, and dentistry. And what we found really is that in many instances, our dark alleys now are our pharmacies. And I wanted to share with you a snapshot of our most recent overdose death in Norfolk County so that you can know and learn from what we are seeing in our communities. The last review was held on June 9th, and it covered deaths occurring between in the 8-week period of time between February 14th and May 20th of this year. And I should mention that the total number of overdose deaths in 2013 that allowed us to get that prestigious federal funding was 63. And I called the Lieutenant Colonel in charge of homicide on my way here, and here today, 2015, we've now hit 94 in Norfolk. There were 43 deaths in Norfolk County that came through the 911 system that we addressed in that meeting. 33 were male and 10 were female. The average age was 36, which was skewed very much by a few older decedents. The average age, as I mentioned, 36, the youngest 19, the oldest 60. Of the 27 communities, 17 had at least one death. There are a number of circumstances that we track because we find them very important in guiding our prevention efforts. Important, I think, for all of you to know that only 14 of those 43 were heroin-only deaths. 11 were opiates and benzos. So pharmaceuticals are playing a very important role in what we're seeing in terms of fatal overdoses and those successfully reversed by all of our first responders in Norfolk County. Five had a contributing impairment from cocaine. Nine of those deceased were actively engaged in drug maintenance at the time. Very important for you to know, because what we're seeing in the patient prescription histories of those who die, and what we're learning from the detectives who arrive on scene to investigate that death, is that in many instances, that victim was actively engaged in drug maintenance, whether buprenorphine that shows up on their patient prescription history or methadone, and at the same time, those patients are able to get prescribed medication, go to a pharmacy, and then those combinations of medicines are causing overdose. 11 of those deceased were recently released from rehab. And when I say recent, I mean within a day or two. I don't mean within a week or a month. I mean that's part of the story as to the familiarity of that 911 caller, understanding of what contributed to that overdose. One thing that we're tracking that may sound unusual, but I share with you because it is so important, is that we've noticed in reviewing the deaths that so many families have recently had their loved one returned to them in rehab, their home, the family's feeling so comfortable, they're back, they're sleeping soundly, their child or their spouse is home, and they're reporting in their 911 call that they left the bedroom or left another room because their loved one was snoring so loudly. And they didn't understand that their child was dying when they heard that. And so they leave and go and sleep on the couch so that their child can sleep finally back at home. And we need to make sure the public understands, as our first responders do when they hear that, that that is an indication of overdose and something that we need to make sure the public knows to recognize and to call 911 when they hear that. Four of those deceased had a prior Narcan reversal. And seven of those deceased were prescribed a drug that we're tracking very closely, known as gabapentin, also known as Neurontin, or a brand name version of Lyrica. And what we've been trying to have that upscheduled so that doctors can be more vigilant about its prescribing and pharmacists more vigilant about its dispensing. But if someone you know and love is taking that drug and also struggling with addiction, that should probably be a great concern to you. A couple of other things I want to share was that two of our deceased were veterans, young veterans, and the VA system, their prescribing doesn't show up in the PMV. So if you have a veteran that you're concerned about, they may have access to medicine both through the VA system and through primary care, traditional insurance, something that we're seeing contributing to double access to medicine and obviously more to contribute to overdose. Again, we are seeing an increase in heroin-only deaths, but there are only 14 of those 43. So we need to clean out our medicine cabinets, be smart about who's providing our health care, and ask more questions about the medicine that our loved ones are getting access.
Talking about the political force up here on the stage. I want to remind you, the political force is out here in this room and making calls to your legislators and your representatives and coming to meetings like this to help us to learn what the needs are. And working with the district attorney's office, I can tell you, I've learned a lot in just a very short period of time. Coming to meetings like this, I've learned a lot in a very short period of time. Hearing a story from somebody like you is a lot in a very short period of time. And I can tell you, there is a commitment to fund these programs, and there's a commitment to get early intervention, which is a key to erasing this problem.
Thank you. I agree with the whole panel. Yeah. But my point is, which still has not been addressed, and I'm addressing this because it's a life and death matter. I understand that they have RIA. I understand they have these programs going, but how many are no cost to the public? We had plenty of them 20 years ago. Where did the money go? They started closing one place and then another place. And myself, I've been to Beach Hill, Mount Pleasant, you name it, I've been there. I got a PhD in it. Okay? But what I'm saying, what is our state government doing today? We've lost friends and children in Franklin. That's why we're here. Okay. I'm talking about the next child or the next kid who, in Franklin, who may not have access to one of these places in Florida or over the West Coast like the celebrities do. I'm talking about regular everyday families that the husband has blown all the money, has blown his insurance, his job, and where does he go for that treatment? You can put all these things together that you want, but until that hits somebody in our neighborhoods that are in that jackpot, that nothing's going to happen, and within a short period of time, that person is either going to overdose or commit a crime.
You're absolutely right.
So my question is, what is our state government doing about putting funds together? Is there even a discussion?
Yes.
We have put money together, as you said, to put this program on. What's happening in the grassroots? That's what I want to know.
Thanks. We'll work. Thank you so much. And I spoke to a lot of people in the letter. If you come over, I'm going to alternate back and forth.
Jeff, can I say something real quick? Obviously, I'm not a politician, but I have to say, I've been attending things like this, being invited to the forum to speak for 4 to 5 days now, and I shared some of the frustrations with that gentleman when I used to go. I would show up and they would ask me questions on drug prevention. I would say I'm obviously not qualified for it. You know, I have no idea how to make sure kids don't start using drugs. And what I can say is over the years, having attended these things, I started to see for a good amount of time now in the conversation at least switch over to, you know, the people who are already addicted, which was not what I was seeing 4 or 5 years ago attending these things. So I don't know anything about funding, I don't know anything about politics. But I do know what it's like to live through it, and I have seen some change. I wouldn't say it's a change that's necessary, but the system we're in right now, however you may view it, however I may view it, might be that me, it's a system we're in. And in that system, there's still hope, and I want to make sure people know that, especially, you know, specifically the family members of the addict and the alcoholic. One of the biggest things I advocate for, and wherever we advocate for, is for you, the family members, to get help right away. My mother, and she wouldn't mind me speaking on this because we have a second relationship nowadays, she didn't help herself. And she got sick right along with me. And the way I obsessed over heroin and crack cocaine is the same way she obsessed over my sobriety. My well-being and my mood is highly dependent on the amount of heroin or drugs I had in my body. Her well-being and her mood was entirely dependent upon my status in sobriety or relapse. And she faced the same consequences as I did. My brother became absolutely neglected. She neglected her work life. She would take for her boss. She didn't be a bank account to get me lawyers and attorneys and get me out of prison. She didn't get help for herself and she wished she had. And when we found that happened was, even though I did manage to get well, she didn't. I moved an hour and a half up north. I found a solution that worked for me. I began to see results. My mom sat at home, going into a sheer panic every time the phone rang past 7 p.m. And she said all she wishes that she had differently, she may get educated a little earlier, a little sooner. So if I could say anything for the families who do it, you know, there could be improvements made to the system, but in the system there is still hope, and the best thing anyone can do for themselves is to get educated for herself, and you can start to get better yourself before your loved one does, which I know seems impossible, but I've seen it happen. So I wanted to really say that, and people know that that's the case.
I just wanted to speak on the Community of Hope, the group that we're holding now on Monday nights. It's on 262 Chestnut Street. It's 7 o'clock. We are almost a larger hope, meeting with Joanne Peterson within the next 2 weeks, and that's going to turn on finally getting some awareness to the theory. That's what my goal was. I tried to do this before, and it never came about until the first coalition meeting, where I met Jim Garrett, and him and I can work, and then other family members. I just want people to know, you just said it perfectly, because that's what I was going to talk about. I have two sons that are addicts, and I was your mom, that you would just explain, and I was crazy, crazier than them. My addiction was them, not heroin. I did everything wrong, and now that I have been going to virtual meetings for many years now, and have done some work and have gotten educated, I'm finally living my life again. I'm not addicted to my children anymore. I just cannot stress enough for anyone that is going through this, for the parents. They really need to get the help. I wish I did years ago. I probably, maybe my kids, like Katie came, pointed out, if the family or the family is in recovery, I think the addict also has a better chance of getting into recovery. So I just want to let you guys know that don't be afraid. I was petrified to walk into my first meeting. It's not an easy thing to do because of the stigma, because of everything that goes along with it. I was devastated, but I did it. And I did it, and I continually go, and I still go to this day, and I won't give up. And I'm so grateful, I'm sorry for going on, but that we're getting this awareness into Franklin. Like the Franklin and surrounding areas. There's lots of people in Franklin and around here and everywhere, and it's so sad. And I just want everyone to know about, please get yourself some help if you have a family member that is an addict. Thanks. That's all.
Concerning in a completely different realm that you might not even consider.
Anybody want to say that?
I can't speak to the science behind that. I'm sure Dr. Kelly has a few comments on that. But I did want to add one thing that we're seeing is that in the age group where most of our overdose victims are, and where we're most concerned is in the college years and older, so after high school, where we see so much pressure and stress, and we see sort of the off-label uses of benzos coming into play with those kids that are have that mentality of work hard and play hard. So I can't speak to the to those who are struggling academically, but I can say that what we're hearing anecdotally from parents and others who are talking about how their child became entangled with both opiates and benzos, a lot of it started, for example, with a sports injury, with a painkiller, and then the addition in college of benzo or another drug that's basically to keep them going, keep them working hard, and that's a deadly combination. We're seeing opiates and benzos as really the leading source of drugs for overdose. So I do believe that there's something to that, but I can only comment that much. I also want to add that we are getting data from the Department of Public Health with respect to the density of opiates and benzos prescribed within Norfolk County. And what was, we don't know why, but in some of our most affluent communities, we're seeing the highest rates of prescribing by patient zip code of stimulants. So something to be vigilant about. We don't know why that is. It could be sought by the patient. It could, but that was a concern to us and something that we're seeing very clearly in our data.
Yes, academic struggles would be a risk factor and correlate with risk for substance use and substance use disorder. There are many things that will correlate with that. It doesn't mean that you're destined to become addicted or to give you new substances, but there is a correlation there. Again, as PDA, people feel pain, they feel less than, they feel ashamed, they feel diminishing major milestones in their development academically, and that can lead people to feel apart and make it more likely that they would use substances. But many people, the majority of people who have academic struggles, do not become addicted, but it is a risk factor.
I was just thinking it's a risk factor that's easy to address. Like it comes up, it happens, and then you get a guidance counselor or whatever, say, hey, just so you know, this is a risk factor.
Hey,
I think I see a lot in my private practice that allows kids who struggle academically, they end up engaging in anxiety and the lack of self-esteem, they end up engaging first in smoking marijuana to reduce that anxiety, and and the process goes further. One of the things that we've been talking about is really educating the parents younger, where everybody comes to back to school night, in the elementary school, in the middle school, is do we have that 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes to really give that education of, as I always say to parents, my son walks into the house and he throws his backpack on the floor, shoots everything, and I'm yelling at him to pick it up, move it, why do you do that? In a few more years, that backpack's going to be upstairs. And why is it now upstairs? Why am I not yelling? Not because he listens to me, it's maybe because he's hiding something in it. So it's those little things that, educating the parents of those tiny things that we need to do when, they're in elementary school and, middle school, not when they get to high school. So it is a lot about education and just finding the forms that parents will come to is the hardest part. So.
Thank you. We'll move to this side.
Thank you. I'm Jim Ledbetter. I'm a family doctor. And I would have thought I could have been a big part of the problem with opiates, but I arrived here in Massachusetts 10 years ago. In 2006, our psychologist in our group said, you guys, if we're prescribing these opiates in the city of Pittsburgh, where we have an even bigger problem with opiates than we have in Franklin, we're probably a part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So this year, I looked at the data that I'm prescribing, and almost two-thirds of our prescriptions for opiates are actually recognizing that that's been an important part of how to deal with a chronically disabled, sometimes high prevalence and other mental illness come in combination with an addiction problem in our town. Youth murder is a huge part of the recovery for our patients, and it hasn't really been addressed tonight. I had no idea that it's even available to somebody in the town of Frank, but I think we have a paucity of doctors willing to provide treatment for addiction. And just as my practice group is challenged by our partner to be part of the solution, those of us in town who have a good relationship with our primary care physicians in the community might have to challenge them if they're prescribing opiates for pain for their patients. Are they also willing to know about how to use buprenorphine to treat the addiction problems that are almost certainly going to develop in some of our patients if they're not extremely careful? So I'd like to know, those of you who are therapy, do your patients have access to buprenorphine if that's a reasonable part of their treatment? What's available here and how do we get that available to you? I will tell you, I'm doing it in Pittsburgh, teaching for the University of Massachusetts Medical School. I train family medicine residents there. And all of our family medicine residents in Pittsburgh and in Worcester are all trained and ready to provide buprenorphine therapy when they graduate from our residency. I wish I could say that for other training programs in our field and other fields around the city. I think that's an access that's really needed in a community like that.
My addiction started with a chronic hip problem. I was born with degenerative hips, and I had ended up giving me Percocet, and they told me on fentanyl patch for almost 2.5 years. I did just Suboxone. I have to say that Suboxone and heroin after, and the withdrawals from methadone and from heroin and Suboxone, withdrawals from Suboxone or methadone are worse than heroin withdrawals. I take the Vivitrol shot, which is, you will not withdraw from it. My opiate addiction started through a primary care. And basically what he did to me was, when I done this to me, I have one full PCP right now who does do the withdrawal. He's not in Franklin. But that's when my addiction started. Really bad. With a job that was starting and starting and starting.
I worked with a lot of substance abuse clients. A lot of them do want to go on Suboxone. Unfortunately, we don't have, we have prescribers in the area, in the Milford area, but their whole practice is not as ethical as myself as a counselor would like to refer to. I want to make sure that my clients are, in other forms of treatment and that they're being closely monitored in regards to Suboxone. And when they're getting Suboxone, it's $300 for the first visit and $150 every week. And they're given 16 milligrams of Suboxone, and do they really need that? And how closely are they being monitored in regards to how much are they taking? I recently have been referring a lot of people to the ASAP program. It's the Adolescent Substance Abuse Program at Mass General Hospital, at Children's Hospital. And I've had wonderful success with them in regards to networking and collaboration, but it is very hard to find a doctor that will, do things in the appropriate way, I guess, maybe that I find it that way. So it has been very hard.
I have to agree with that, because when I went to the doctor and looked at my Suboxone, and every time I did urine, I tested urine, and he still gave me my Suboxone.
I mean, I think that, remember, Suboxone is definitely a help, it's an evidence-based practice, but it's not the universal panacea. Many people drop out of buprenorphine treatment, especially in adults who need it the most, in terms of destabilizing addiction patterns. We need all the other things in place. You can't just say, given a prescription of Suboxone and say, that's all we need to do. That's dangerous thinking, and people will still continue to take other opioids. We need other kinds of support services as well as Suboxone.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to imply that just sitting in that room that a prescription is what we need. There's certainly an indication of muscle therapy. And it's covered under our state's Mass Health and Medicaid program, so it is available for those basically free to the poor who would otherwise not be able to get access to care. As is behavioral health, although sometimes very long waits to get it treated for our patients who are relying on the Mass Health system.
Thank you. Move to the side.
Hi, yes, my name is Christina. My son is 22, and I am too, just a little bit changing, just from being up here. I went to Kathy's meeting on Monday, and it was terrifying walking in there alone first time. I have been struggling too, trying to find my way, but learning and realizing I need to just be doing this and learning by myself, because I've been kind of driving my son into meetings with me, but just knowing that I need to do this on my own and change the family, try to help him. I sectioned him voluntarily last week, but you know, I had sectioned him before, and he did well, but he was on methadone and wasn't the best choice. Tried to box him, but again, sometimes you know, you can take it and sometimes you don't have to, and there wasn't always counseling that went with it. So we are trying to do the trouble he said you were on for. And, you know, it's kind of learning in terms of the networking, like to the learning coach, and we definitely would love to be a name and be part of that. But I also have a question about what you said. I have some medical issues, and my son months ago had told me, I took Zyrca, and he had told me months ago, like, people were buying that, and it really kind of threw me for a loop. So I got off of that. I had been on it for years for seizures, and stopped taking that last about, so that kind of threw me for a loop that was something that people or kids were taking. And I wondered, well, I probably can't say why.
John's on the street.
Yeah.
John also on the
street. It's sort of the and then it sort of got the nickname of Johnny's on the street. But that drug, we talked to our narcotics detectives, is the most sought after drug on the street.
Really?
And well, Lyrica, gabapentin, neurontin, and I don't know what your thoughts are, but the off-label use of that medicine is to enhance the high and low pain. And so there's this added euphoria that prolongs and enhances that high. And our concern, when I mentioned the data that we look at in our overdose death review, we look at the patient prescription history of that person, and we see what that person had access to, just as a prescriber could or a pharmacist could at the time they write the prescription or fill it. Lyrica came on the market as a brand name as a Schedule 5, so it's on the prescription drug monitoring program, and doctors can see it, and there's a limit on the refills, so there's a limit as to the supply a person can have of it. Not so with gabapentin and neurontin, the generics.
Yes.
So there is a huge supply in our communities of those drugs, in large part because of the access to that medicine. Many employers, many probation departments and others don't screen for those drugs, and so it's not detected. So that's why there's such a big demand for it, and unfortunately, because of the way it's scheduled, there's a big supply for it.
And I know, you know, I knew that was never touched. It was always Lyrica, but, you know, even if you've been locked, and I know in reality, you know, you can have it locked up, but at least 200, it's not common to use this, but you could just pick up a big safe. So, you know, I have to keep it away. So I really wouldn't know if this
gone to every one of the 120 pharmacies in Norfolk County to ask them to help us reinforce our message of safe storage and disposal so that there isn't extra medicine sitting in our homes, because it is so dangerous and kids are dying from it, and they're getting that medicine from our own homes. Just as we said. So the responsibility is really on us as patients and parents to take some action and start looking at that medicine as if it were a problem.
I know we've passed the 9 o'clock hour, and I want to be respectful of everybody's time. So we'll take these last three questions here. We'll start with you.
Hi, my name's Robin, and my son is an addicted to heroin. And he's currently on a control shot. But I think, so I have kind of two questions.
Yeah, a little closer to the mic. A little bit.
So I kind of have two questions. Or maybe a comment, I'm not sure. So the best chance for recovery is long-term treatment. My son's been through 7 different rehabs between detox, 30 days, 28 days, the whole thing. So, in what I've learned is that the intervention piece, if you have to intervene into the detox, to the 30 days, to the inpatient, to the sober living, to possibly sober coach, like through the Gosnell program in Selma, I did an intervention on him, and he sadly didn't stay in the program. But my question stems from what that gentleman said about people that have no insurance. My question is, what about people that do? I have Harvard Pilgrim insurance, yet I'm a single mom, 3 kids, I work full time, because I don't have MassHealth, only a piece of that long-term treatment is covered. So for my son, if he agreed to stay there, I would have had to figure a way to pay close to $20,000 to keep him in the long-term care, which is what they say is the best chance of recovery. So is there anything in place trying to, when I look at that graph where the healthcare cost is like minimal, is there anything for in place researching maybe what the insurance companies do cover when you do have insurance?
I got the income for that. I got the income also. There are scholarship programs for them to pay for it. There's scholarships. Go to the case manager, Miller, I know who did the intervention. She's a great resource. But there are scholarships that will pay for it.
Right, and I can do that. I guess my question, though, is there anything that's being looked into the healthcare being more responsible for some of the longer term, and not just saying, oh, they can detox for 7 days and then I can treat the outpatient, where that's just not successful.
We have passed some legislation to require longer stays, but it's not addressing the exact situation that you're looking at. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I'm hoping to do as a program somewhere down the road, I haven't found the insurance company executive that's willing to get up on this stage. That's something that's in mind, because I can tell you that probably the most frustrating calls that I receive and speak to people is about that very issue. We're trying to get better coverage, trying to get better coordination. I'm going to pass it off to Jen because I think she has a better answer.
Okay.
I just wanted to add that we have the pharmacy directors for the 5 main insurance providers in Massachusetts participating in our state prescribing work groups, so Blue Cross, Tufts, Harvard Pilgrim, and MassHealth also participates. And the trend is absolutely, from an insurance perspective, to lower the day supply of medicine covered, because that's our source, and to spend that money on treatment resources. So there's absolutely a lot of work being done in limiting day supply. And if you look at the amount of medicine that was paid for by MassHealth for those who die of overdose in Norfolk County, it would blow your mind. And to see that those individuals were trying to find treatment options is heartbreaking. Yet that same source of funding was paying for all of the medicine that contributed to their overdose. So I hear you, and I agree with you, and I do believe
80% of the world's opioids. That should be a very eye-opening statistic. And just think, if we weren't spending all that money on the opioids, how much money would be available for these treatment programs?
For more treatment. Because, I mean, I can get any prescription for anything covered by insurance, but you can't get the treatment piece. You can get the detox if you want to. You do have to fight it a lot of times, because they will tell you that heroin addiction can be treated outpatient, and they will deny it. They denied my son more than once when he was 15, and another time when he was 17. But as I appeal, you know, eventually I get in, but it's just good to know that there's stuff happening.
It is a work in progress. There's a lot of progress that can be made in terms of ensuring people to provide treatment for the consequences that addiction is.
Mm-hmm.
But we're a long way from where we want to be. There was an act passed, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act passed in 2008. There's a lot of breaking of that law, a lot of loopholes that insurance companies get away with. And there is the Affordable Care Act, which has within its narrative laws to ensure that people can get adequate treatment, including for addiction. But these things are going to take a while for all of that to come online and be regulated and enforced so that it is people get the treatment that they need.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Peggy, and I wanted to ask the man of the that said that he was lucky enough to go to a sober house in Wakefield. I'm wondering, how did you get there? I mean, did you go, you said you were in jail, did you go from jail? Did you go from detox?
No, but I had to go to detox first, they acquired. But I came to know the program because a friend of mine had gone to be one of the first guests that went through that 9 years ago. And I recall the story when I was just hanging out with him one day, as I came, picked him up for an exception, and we went off to treatment, and I set to see him back 30 days later, using it. And then 2 months went by, 3 months went by, and we don't have to ask the question, where's Mark? And he went away and he got better. And he would come back and he would offer himself to me, and he kept planting a seed of hope, telling me about the program, telling me what he's doing. And eventually I just pursued entry into the program, and I just followed their guidelines, which at that time was to go to a detox facility, a 30-day treatment center, and then I'd be able to go into the program. So I had to follow those sort of guidelines at that time. The guidelines have since changed, but I originally heard of it through word of mouth from a friend of mine who's also since that. But almost all sober facilities you're going to have to go to a detox facility at least before you're eligible for entry. We require at least you go to the DB completely medically free. We're not a medical facility. So we require the better of these medical clearance until something comes down to arrive.
Right, but getting that 30-day piece, that's the problem.
I've also lived in Sohouse. What I did though, I went into Emerson House at 30 days of sleep. I know people that come out of detox and go to sober houses. You have to pass your dermal test before they'll ever accept you. I went to detox and relapsed, but then I went into the house 30 days clean, went into a long treatment program, and I came out and found a sober house, and they helped me do that. The case manager helped me do that.
And while you were in the sober house, they help you find a job? You have to find a job?
What it is you take random urines and you can be held accountable. And then you need to look for a job because you need to kind of start your life, get a small job, and start having responsibilities and other things you can concentrate on. But all in the state, you have curfews, you have random urines, you have chores. You have to be held accountable. And you
look
for your own
talk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn to you, and I see you, ma'am. I will not close the microphone. You
stand
stay there, and we'll get you up as soon as the show ends.
My name is Sean, and I'm a high school student.
of substance abuse at my age? Because you said the target group, the people that are using it most, are my age. I went through the health program about 2 or 3 years ago. Not once was heroin mentioned, not once was coke mentioned, not once was ecstasy mentioned. All they told me was that alcohol and weed would ruin my life. Weed is something to criminalize. I don't understand why that was ignored. And I, you know, I watch friends go through trouble with speed, and I know people who have had their lives affected by these substances. And the only reason I knew that it was bad was after the fact, and I have seen that it ruined the lives of a lot of musicians that I listened to. That's the only way I knew, not because I was educated about it, little nervous, educated about it at school.
Thank you, Jen. Can you handle that?
A lot more can be done. I think that, and I did want to add, you work very closely with Superintendent Faculty. Kristen Starks, who gets more done in a day than a lot of people do in a month, attends every one of our more flexible partnership meetings, and has been a huge component of ESPER, which Dr. Kelly mentioned, and it's a program that EA Morrissey intends to fund as one of our grants to schools this year, which is a way of taking someone who's already very trusted with a lot of the students, the school nurse, in the context of, say, postural screening, where you're asking questions in a confidential, private environment. You're talking about vision, and you're testing for hearing, and you're looking for scoliosis, and at the same time, as part of that conversation, the school nurse, who all the kids know, who has a pretty good sense of the pulse of what's going on in the school, just like our coaches do and our athletic trainers do, can ask those important questions and start identifying and referring for treatment students who are in school age, who can benefit from that. As far as the education piece goes, that's obviously a decision made by the school district, but I can tell you that Maureen Sabalinski has been a tremendous partner of ours in every one of our initiatives. So I think it's one of those issues. It's like when sexting became the big topic, and it was, that's what all of the cameras were following at high schools, and parents in schools were concerned about, well, how do you talk about that without either, you know, putting a spotlight on it, or you don't want to show kids what's really going on, but do it in a way that helps educate them and prevent the kinds of tragedies that we're all here today to try to prevent at the community level. And doing that in school setting isn't easy. But I think that a lot of work is being done locally to try to educate kids. One of the first projects I did when I took over as director of crime prevention was to develop a diversion program for Norfolk County. So kids who became court involved, those growing up kinds of offenses, minor possession of alcohol, those possession of Class C cases before the legislative changes, that those kids could participate in an educational program, participate in the Brains at Risk class, get some information about substance abuse, perform some community service for the community in which they've offended, and not get it waived so that they weren't becoming ineligible for college or employment. And we make that programming available to schools to use as a part of the disciplinary response to, say, a chemical health violation. So that you're not just suspending a kid who's found with marijuana for 5 days. You can inject some education and some learning as a part of that response and have a student back in school in 2 or 3 days without providing them a week to sit at home and smoke pot on the couch. So that's something that a lot of our school districts have really stepped up and incorporated to make some of those lower-level chemical health violations into very important teachable moments. Because if someone who's prosecuted one vehicle homicide for a very long time, sexual assault of beautiful young kids who get raped at parties, there are a lot of unintended consequences to substance abuse that kids in high school don't see. And as a mother of 2 high school students, I can tell you that they suffer with the kinds of things that I've had to see in my job. But those are the kinds of things that kids your age are grappling with. It isn't getting easier to grow up. But I think that you probably are getting a lot of information from a lot of different things in your life. You're here tonight. You know what the issues are. And I think that's really important. You should be really proud of standing up and saying that.
I also want to
to Sylvia at the last meeting. She talked about the curriculums that were going to be introduced into the schools in the next school year. And this chairwoman of the Franklin School Committee is also there. I know that that's an important topic for both of them. Thank you for bringing that up. Dan, you want to get the last word?
Yes, hi, my name is Diana. I live in Franklin. I've been affected personally as well.
Can you step up closer to the mic?
My name is Diana. I live here in Franklin. As everyone else, I've been affected personally as well as other ways. I have some thoughts more than asking a question. It appears that there are many organizations / agencies working on this issue. Is there any streamlined way that we can all get together on this? I have been in human services my whole life as an income and housing advocate. And there are coalitions come and go, and yet people are still homeless, and we need a living wage. So therefore, my question is, who is really looking into the current programs that are out here serving our kids, our young people, our adults, our old people, and which programs are really effective and which programs are not? We need to take a look at this. That's my first comment. Second, I echo everybody with insurance. We're on the state level, and I think someone did allude to that fact that they're working on trying to change the insurance. Well, I recall when my father was having trouble, and he is a recovering alcoholic now for over 35 years in the early 70s, that they changed the criteria by which alcoholism was looked at and changed it to a disease. Now, is there something going on in this level statewide that is also having a different aspect of how we look in order for our insurance agencies, who really control way too much of our personal lives without knowing us, is there anything that we can do on this end? Last thing I will leave with everyone here today. The town of Franklin was awarded $50,000 for this coalition or some coalition in town. It has been unclear to me, I don't know about anybody else, who is actually the people who are going to utilize this $50,000. And if we know the answer to this question today, Representative Roy, who exactly and what exactly is $50,000 going to be used for and by whom? Thank you.
About whether there are people looking for streamlining.
Yeah, there are lots of efforts trying to identify community best practices for different agencies that agree with you. There are a multitude of efforts going on because communities are affected and people are mobilized to do different things and they try their best to do it in a way they think will help. I do want to just emphasize two things coming up. One that comes to mind is an effort, a nationally mobilizing effort called United for Faith Addiction, which is going to happen on October 4th on the Washington Mall in D.C. There are over 200 organizations nationally that have signed on to that. If you Google United for Faith Addiction, you'll find the page, you'll see that there's a national effort to bring this to the attention of Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. on October 4th. Okay? You have September, it's recovery month, coming right out around the corner here, September. Again, this is an opportunity to make your voice heard from walks, to get all this in front of the center, in front of legislators, and Capitol buildings all around the country. This has been mobilizing now for the last 15 years, and on October 4th, down in Washington, D.C., there's going to be this big national effort to help consolidate the whole young center for this addiction epidemic.
On the $50,000 question, could have been a $64,000 question, but it is a $50,000 question. That money was just appropriated. The governor had vetoed it. The House just and the Senate overrode that veto just a week ago. So until last week, we weren't certain whether we were going to get that money. We are working in conjunction with town officials to establish how that funding is going to be used. Hopefully it will be used to bring some programs like this to the community. It will be used to get literature and resources. direction for expenditure funds like that, and we will use it wisely. I want to thank everyone for participating in this event. I want to thank Dr. Kelly for an absolutely fascinating presentation, and each member of the panel. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to that. I assume that you're still with us. So as we close this special session, let me remind you that if you like what we're doing here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something, please let me know. It's through that kind of feedback loop that I can help to improve the information we provide to you. And I really appreciate your listening. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is entitled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.